This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. 40 years ago today, at a ballroom in Harlem, a leading voice in the civil rights movement was gunned down by assassins as he took the podium. There is no national holiday to commemorate the life of Malcolm X, but his impact lives on within the black community. Tonight, at a newly restored Audubon Ballroom, his family gathers with those who were there on that fatal day to celebrate his life and legacy. Malcolm X is often compared and contrasted with Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. King preached nonviolence and interracial harmony, while Malcolm's infamous slogan, "By any means necessary," came to characterize his career. Those means included black self-reliance and violent resistance. He's been called the prophet of the Black Power generation, and his words have influenced young people from the Black Panthers in the 1960s to hip-hop stars today. This hour, the people who knew Malcolm join us to share their personal stories about his philosophy and his work, the continuing controversies over how to remember him. We want to hear from you as well. If you have a personal story or an experience with Malcolm, about his teachings, how they shaped your life, let us know. Unfortunately, our phones are down, but you can get in. You'll have to call a 202 number, and we will call you back. So the 202 number to call is 202-408-7544. It's a 202 number, 408-7544. If you call us, we'll call you back. You can also send us an email at totn@npr.org. And if you want to include your phone number on that email, we will call you and get you on the air to talk about the life and legacy of Malcolm X. Our guest this hour is Manning Marable. He is the director of the Center for Contemporary Black History at Columbia University. He's the editor of Souls, a critical journal of black politics, culture, and society, and joins us from our bureau in New York City. Manning, welcome.
Yes, thank you. It's great to be here.
I just mentioned Malcolm's the iconic slogan, "By any means necessary." What did that mean to him?
It meant a firm and unaltering commitment to African-American freedom. But I believe that the intro overplayed the differences, the distinctions between King and Malcolm, which regrettably still to this day continues in our textbooks. The reality is that several weeks prior to Malcolm's assassination, Malcolm went to Selma, Alabama to express his solidarity and support for Dr. King in the effort to desegregate the Deep South. And he informed King's wife, Coretta, that even though the media portrayed him as kind of the avatar of violence, that he and Dr. King were both working toward the same ends, but used different strategies to achieve those ends. That Malcolm and Martin both, keep in mind, opposed the war in Vietnam. They both were strongly in favor of internationalizing the black freedom struggle. They both had a firm commitment to building strong black institutions. And the tendency to see the two as antipodes, I think, needs to be laid to rest.
That tendency, though, can you forgive it, given the rhetoric of Malcolm X for most of his career and the fact that perhaps his reputation hadn't quite caught up with him by the time he died? Is that fair?
Well, Malcolm was trying, to use his own words, to turn a corner. He had broken with the Nation of Islam, a black separatist organization. He had formed the Organization of Afro-American Unity. He was focused on the necessity for African Americans to take their case for human rights to the United Nations. He was internationalizing the struggle for black freedom. And it was difficult, given the media blockade against a critical discussion of the content of his ideas, for him to turn that corner. I think that the other thing we need to keep in mind is that much of what we know about Malcolm X has really been framed in subsequent generations by two works. The autobiography of Malcolm X, a book that was co-authored with Alex Haley, the journalist and celebrated author of Roots, and years later by Spike Lee's 1992 biopic, Malcolm X, which framed his image in a particular kind of way. that emphasized and gave too much space, rather, to the earlier Malcolm of the Detroit Red period of the 1940s, when he was a gangster, a petty hustler in Harlem, and not enough space, really, frankly, to the last year of his life. Nothing really substantive about the content of his political ideas, his political agenda, and how he was attempting to turn that corner.
We're talking this hour about the legacy of Malcolm X with scholar Manning Marable, and we invite your phone calls. A little bit of a change today. I'm going to give you a 202 number, 202-408-7544. If you call that, we'll call you back. Our phones are down, but apparently our 800 number is down. 202-408-7544 if you have a story that you'd like to pass on or a question for Manning Marable and our other guest this hour. Also, you can send us an email at totn@npr.org. What was the content of that message?
I think that Malcolm's message was one of hope and human affirmation that so much, you know, we have to take our listeners back to America in the 1940s and 50s and how deeply segregated this society was, that in 1964 there were only 5 blacks in Congress. There was not a single African-American who was elected mayor of any city or town in this country, that this is all prior to affirmative action. It's prior to the desegregation of public accommodations. In that environment, the message of the Nation of Islam, led by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, a black separatist religious organization that drew upon elements of traditional Islam, but framed within a separatist race-based ideology or creed, made sense to many African Americans. The Nation of Islam talked about the need for blacks to have solidarity, to build strength, capacity within their own neighborhoods, communities that were already segregated. Malcolm came up out of that organization, but realized that its vision was truncated and limited, that he began, long before he broke publicly with the Nation of Islam, to explore another route, the idea of reaching out to civil rights organizations and leaders. And in the biography that I've been working on for a number of years, I've found a great deal of evidence to that point. And I believe that that's part of the reason why he became subjected to so much illegal surveillance and harassment by the Federal Bureau of Investigation and by the New York Police Department's Bureau of Special Services called BOSS.
Let's go to the phones now. Deborah is on the line from Tempe, Arizona. Hello, Deborah.
Hi.
You have a question?
Hi. Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question about what you mentioned, some kind of touched on it when you were talking about the role of journalism and news reporting, how they tended to avoid him or avoid talking or giving him airtime or page time. What was the relationship, I'm curious, between the ideas of Malcolm and Martin Luther King? Did they entertain, did they try to articulate their goals? And if so, how? And the only other question or comment I wanted to make was, it seemed like the 60s we had a lot of promising leaders and they were all murdered. It seems unprecedented to me. And so that was my comment. So,
all right.
The first part was the question.
I'd like to begin with the second part first. In the early 1960s, the FBI launched a program called COINTELPRO, the Counterintelligence Program. And the acronym was COINTELPRO was an effort to have surveillance and disruption of groups deemed by then head of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, to be subversive or against the national interest, even if they committed no crimes, even if there were no warrants out for their leadership or any overt activity against the law. And so Malcolm was subjected, as well as Dr. King, to this kind of infiltration of his organization, disruption. And all of this, really, his you know, the history of that kind of intimidation and surveillance has not yet been fully told. There are over 20,000 pages of FBI surveillance of Malcolm X that still remains classified, unavailable to the American public, even though Americans' tax money went to pay for that. So I think that perhaps now, with the 40th anniversary of Malcolm's assassination, the time has come really for the FBI and the federal government, as well as those other federal agencies, to unlock the doors and just let scholars and the American public see what that surveillance was of Malcolm X.
I want to talk with you more about the barriers to scholarship and some of the other roadblocks that you've encountered, but I want to get also to the first part of Deborah's question, which was the relationship between Dr. King and Malcolm X, particularly later toward the end of his life, Malcolm's life.
There was a deep respect that the two men had for each other, despite Malcolm's tendency to overplay his rhetorical hand on the stage. There was no one at all during his generation who was equipped to debate with Malcolm X. Malcolm was on the stage debating James Farmer, the head of the Congress of Racial Equality, Bayard Rustin, who was the chief architect of the historic 1963 March on Washington. And it was invariably Malcolm who would emerge as the debate winner, because Malcolm had a tremendously engaging sense of humor, a profoundly human contact charisma that he made with audiences of all types and of all racial backgrounds that was truly astonishing.
Well, we're going to take a break right here and come back to some of that, and we will also hear some archive tape from Malcolm X as we explore his life and legacy today. We hope to hear from you. Give us a call. Get this at 202-408-7544. We'll call you back, or you can send us an email at totn@npr.org. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. We're talking about Malcolm X, one of the most today on the program, and we're taking your phone calls at 202. It's a different number today because our 800 line is down. 202-408-7544, and you can send us an email at totn@npr.org with your phone number, and we'll call you back to join in our conversation with Black History scholar Manning Marable of Columbia University. Manning, just before the break, you were talking about the rhetorical abilities and humor of Malcolm X. So we have some tape, a clip of tape from one of Malcolm X's speeches. This one in 1963, when he challenges the goals of the mainstream desegregation movement.
The only revolution based on loving your enemy is the Negro Revolution. The only revolution in which the goal is a desegregated lunch counter, a desegregated theater, a desegregated park, and a desegregated public toilet. You can sit down next to white folks on the toilet.
Malcolm X in 1963, Manning Marable, he had a way of speaking very directly and with a voice that was authentic and clear.
That's right, and even more so that he was an astute ethnographer and folklorist. He incorporated folklore, humor, so much of what the greatest African-American humor that emerged at the end of the 20th century, embodied by Richard Pryor. You can hear Pryor 20, 30 years earlier in Malcolm. He used wit. He used ridicule. But the purpose, his goal was to create, you know, to coin or to take the phrase from the literary scholar, the late literary scholar Edward Said, Malcolm's goal was to create new souls. Mm. He wanted to transform the souls of African-American people and reverse the racial dialectic where blacks or people of color were at the bottom and whites were at the top. He wanted blacks to see themselves in a new way and to become new souls. That is, makers of their own history, challenging authority. and challenging whites to see themselves outside of the color of their own skin. He was perhaps the first deconstructionist of white privilege.
We are remembering the 40th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X today with my guest Manning Marable, director of the Center for Contemporary Black History at Columbia University. And we're joined now by Peter Bailey, one of the original members of the Organization of Afro-American Unity, which Malcolm founded in 1964. Mr. Bailey was also a pallbearer at Malcolm X's funeral. And Peter Bailey, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
You were at the funeral. Take us back to that day.
The day of the funeral?
Yes.
Well, I can remember that it was for me personally, one of the most depressing days of my life. In fact, I think I felt really sadder than I did when my much-loved grandfather had died, because my grandfather died when he was about 83, and our brother Malcolm was only 39, and I felt my grandfather's loss was like a personal loss to me and my family. But I felt that the loss of Brother Malcolm was the loss to us as a people.
What was your personal relationship with him? How did you come to the movement, and how did you come to know Malcolm X?
Well, I moved to Harlem in 1962, and I remember I moved in on a Friday, and that Saturday I decided to walk down Lenox Avenue, which is Harlem's main drag, down just to look at the community, because I didn't really know Harlem. In fact, my attitude about Harlem at the time was formed by what I had heard and read in the newspapers. Everybody was drug addicts, junkies, and whores. Truly, that was my image of Harlem. But I moved in because I got a very, very cheap rent. So when I walked down Lenox Avenue, I got down to near 116th Street, and I saw a crowd gathering. And I remember asking someone, what's going on? And they said that Malcolm X is going to be speaking. Now, I had heard of him very vaguely at that time, usually as a boogeyman, who was talking about, doing away with white folks.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided to stand and listen to what he had to say. At that time, I had been involved in the civil rights movement. But I listened, and I heard him. And for the first time in my life, I realized that I had never heard the real state of race relations in this country put forth with such clarity. And such forthrightness, and it completely mesmerized me from the very beginning. And he mentioned a couple of books and magazines. I went out immediately the next day and to see if I could find copies of those books and magazines. And I think the most important thing I remember from that first speech on a summer afternoon in June 1962 was that him saying that we were not up against an individual, up against a George Wallace or a Bull Connor or a Senator Easton. We were up against a system of white supremacy. And I had never heard anyone say it like that before. The civil rights movement basically kind of gave you the impression that if you got rid of George Wallace and you got rid of Bull Connor and some of the people who thought like them, that everything would be cool. Brother Malcolm was not saying that. He was saying that there's a system of rape, of white supremacy in this country, and that is this system that we are in confrontation with. And that was completely eye-opening to me.
As you came to that conclusion, as you saw that new vision, what did that mean for you in terms of your place in the movement? What were you going to do?
It meant that I had always felt as though there was something missing for me in the civil rights movement. I had first got involved in 1960 when I was a student at Howard University, and we used to go and picket Woolworths to show our support for the sit-ins that happened down in Greensboro. But there was always something missing. And when I heard Brother Malcolm, I realized what it was. I had, just the clarity and also his emphasis on the psychological damage of white supremacy, as well as the physical damages, but the mind thing that was being played on us with everything, movies, television, radio, books, newspapers, magazines, that all of this was helping to perpetuate a sense of inferiority or a sense of second-class mentality among black people. And he was one of the first people that I heard to address that. And I was very, very impressed and very, very moved and very, very oriented toward, I want to, hear more about what this brother is saying. And so I began to go wherever he was speaking in the New York City metropolitan area. I would make sure I was there. I could not get close to him because I was not prepared to become a Muslim.
Manny Marable, you heard this, you know, as Peter talks about this hearing something that had been missing. As these two men moved together, as you suggest that Malcolm X was coming to a better understanding and perhaps a closer relationship with Martin Luther King, speculate for a moment on what it might have meant if these two men had appeared on the same podium at some point in the movement.
I think that that's what terrified the FBI and the U.S. government, that you could have a unified, strong black movement. Remember that several years, not long after Malcolm's assassination, that J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, writing in COINTELPRO, in the counterintelligence papers, there is a warning about so-called the Black Messiah Memorandum, which said that the worst thing that could possibly happen would be a unity within the African-American freedom struggle, the emergence of a so-called Black Messiah that could unify the movement. I think that in my research on Malcolm X, one of the things I've discovered is along the way is that there are three chapters that are missing from the manuscript, the published manuscript of the autobiography of Malcolm X, which were written probably based on at least the textual analysis of them in late 1963, early 64, as Malcolm is segueing out of the Nation of Islam into what becomes developing his own political organizations, the MMI, the Muslim Mosque Incorporated, and then the OAAU, the Organization of Afro-American Unity. Malcolm is already envisioning the Nation of Islam taking the lead in developing a non-sectarian, broad-based, pluralistic, united front of black organizations, building capacities within African-American communities, struggling against structural racism and white supremacy, building unity across lines of class and income and education within African-American neighborhoods. Now, he was already thinking this way even before he left the NOI. Had he developed a program and a unity reaching out to Dr. King, to James Farmer, to Bayard Rustin, to A. Philip Randolph and others, which was possible, I believe, that would have spelled, from the standpoint of the U.S. power structure, a real challenge. And I believe that that's one of the reasons why he came under such scrutiny, mm-hmm. harassment, and surveillance. And hi, Peter, it's good to be with you this afternoon.
Hey, Ben, it's same to you, brother.
Let's go out to Kansas. Carl is on the line. Hi, Carl.
Hey, yes, how you doing, sir?
Good.
Let me say I enjoy this so much, and the gentleman that teaches at Columbia University, I'm going to try to get in contact with him.
You're in contact with him now. You have a question?
Yes. Well, what I wanted to just share, and I was talking to you, the lady that answered my call, uh-huh. is that when I was in high school in Chicago, where I'm from, my biology teacher, Miss Jenkins, she played a Malcolm X tape. And at that time, I had never heard of a Malcolm X. But next thing I know, I'm president of the Calumet Afro-American Student Organization. And in college, I was president of concerned black students and BSU and so forth, but it's just the way he talked and whatnot that gave me the leadership skills. And then later on, I met the spiritual world heavyweight champion, Minister Louis Farrakhan, which was a student of Elijah and a student of Malcolm, as he said. And that gentleman from Columbia University is very much so accurate in what he's saying, but I didn't know it was some missing pages in the autobiography, missing chapters in the autobiography of Malcolm X. Wow.
That's right. That's wow. right.
Thank you all so much. And what university is that he teaches at?
Columbia University. Yep, that's at Columbia.
Is that in Missouri?
No, Columbia in New York.
Oh, New York. Okay.
Yep.
Well, my pleasure.
Thank you for your
thank
call.
You. Yes.
Carl and Peter Bailey, I want to thank you, too, the one of the original members of the Organization of Afro-American Unity, an author, of course, the Organization of Afro-American Unity founded by Malcolm X. Peter, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Talk a little bit more about those three missing chapters you talked about.
Yes. Well, when people work on books and collaborate with another author, the book itself is a negotiation. And we have to keep in mind that the autobiography is a brilliant work of literature. The New York Times, I believe the Time magazine cited it in 1998 or 9 as one of the 10 most influential nonfiction works of the 20th century, placing it alongside of The Diary of Anne Frank and 8 other works. So it's millions of copies have been sold. And it does brilliantly present an interpretation of the life of Malcolm Little / Malcolm X / El Hajj Malik El Shabazz. But like all memoirs, which is what this work is, it is selective in the orchestration of events and in the telling of the tale. Malcolm's life was infinitely more complex, more complicated than this brilliant work really presents. Haley also had a very different agenda than Malcolm. Malcolm first started writing the autobiography in part as a statement to honor and glorify Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam. But quickly, within months after beginning the work, he began to feel estranged from the NOI. And by the end of 1963, he found himself silenced and then, in effect, ousted from his own organization. Mm-hmm. Haley's motives were quite different. Haley was a liberal Republican. He was an integrationist. He seized the story because Malcolm was charismatic. He was newsworthy. He was a prominent figure in the press. And because it made good copy. But Haley did not share Malcolm's views in the least. As he got into the story, the reason that he did the book, I believe, is because he felt that it was a warning to white America of what would occur if you had draconian racial segregation, if Jim Crow and the ghettoization of blacks throughout the country were permitted unchecked, that it breeds, in effect, what Mike Wallace called the hate that hate produced. It creates a separatist ideology that was against the American way and the American way of life. And so it became, both men had different motives for the collaboration. But by 64, with Malcolm's trip to Mecca and the transformation of how he saw himself, then you had a different kind of motivation for Malcolm. And we'll never know, since he was assassinated 40 years ago on this date, and the book comes out at the end of 1965 with a different publisher. Keep in mind that 3 weeks after Malcolm's assassination, the Macmillan Press basically pulled the plug on the book and reneged on the contract with Haley. Haley had to thrash around and finally reached an agreement with Grove, which is why Grove Press was the original publisher.
Manning, I want you to hold on to that thought for just a moment as I remind our listeners that they are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Frank Stachow, sitting in for Neil Conan. Manning Marable is my guest, director of the Center for Contemporary Black History at Columbia University, telling us the story of the autobiography of Malcolm X, some of which has been some key chapters, really, left out.
That's right. And if, in fact, if you open up the book today, you only see fleeting references to the Organization of Afro-American Unity, which was his organization. I mean, I always felt in reading the book that something is missing, that there is no political program or agenda that is in the autobiography. But why?
Do you think that Haley had, it got deleted? Do you think Haley was, this was a deliberate effort to sort of soft pedal the message of Malcolm X?
To frame it in a particular way? Well, let's take Haley at his word. He does say that later on in his career, before his death, that this was a joint decision. And it is possible, it's plausible. Malcolm goes to Mecca. There is this epiphany, a spiritual epiphany. And he begins to back away from any kind of overt identification that he may have written and framed with the NOI. There is another interpretation that one could have here, though, that prior to the agreement he reached with Malcolm, what Malcolm did not know is that in 1962, when Haley first became Well, I think we have to take a break
We'll come back to that story.
Only for a second, yes.
All right. We will return after a short break. More about Malcolm X after he left the Nation of Islam, or NOI, later in the program. Your letters. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Tomorrow, a presidential quiz. Find out how much you really know about our nation's presidents. First, we're finishing our discussion about the life and legacy of Malcolm X with historian and author Manning Marable of Columbia University. Joining us now is New York Congressman Charles Rangel. He once said of Malcolm X, "He is one of Harlem's greatest citizens and remains an inspiration to people everywhere as a figure of strength, self-reliance in the face of oppression." Congressman Rangel, then a New York State legislator, recalls being invited to address Malcolm's followers. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
When and how did you come to know Malcolm X?
Through my very dear friend, Percy Sutton, who was his longtime lawyer and friend, and counseled him throughout his life, as well as his widow and his family, and even today.
What was it that struck you about him?
The difference between the Malcolm X that I saw on television, and the charm and the intellect and the friendliness of the man in terms of his off-camera appearance.
Was there a sense at that time, you know, we've been talking about the legacy, the image of the man, and perhaps compared and contrasted with Martin Luther King. You've heard Manning Marable say that that contrast was perhaps a somewhat of a false dichotomy or overplayed. Was there a sense at the time that there was a big difference between these two men and the two visions that they espoused?
Well, the way you ended it, I was eager to say, yes, there was a difference. But in the objective and what they wanted to achieve, I don't think there was a difference. It was just a difference in the methods in which you went. I don't really think that Malcolm thought that he had to wait for his civil rights, that he really thought he was a human being and was entitled to the dignity that he deserved, rather than asking the government and those in politics to give him his rights.
What is the legacy of Malcolm X?
Well, I don't know how many of your listeners are familiar with Marcus Garvey, who preceded Malcolm X. He came to the United States from the West India Islands and was preaching an identification of oneself and self-respect among, I guess we didn't call ourselves African-Americans, but Negroes. And also to reclaim our dignity as a people in returning to Africa. That didn't work out too well, and he was found guilty of some people that feared him in the United States, and I'm working desperately hard to get his name exonerated. I think Malcolm followed along those lines in realizing that those who are families of slaves, those who have no history that was kept intact, those who, Malcolm X said, had no names of their own, but merely European names, and that's why he used the name X in one part of his life. Those who had no sense of self-esteem, that the only standards that we had were European standards, it was Malcolm, who was really trying to educate the American Negro that you had to have a sense of self-esteem, even though America has taken away all of your sense of language and culture, and indeed caused many blacks, and some today, to dislike themselves based on the darkness of their skin.
Congressman, thank you very much.
Have a good day.
New York Congressman Charles Rangel joined us by phone from his home in New York City. We're talking today about the legacy of Malcolm X, and you can join the conversation by sending us an email at totn@npr.org or call in on a 202 number today, 202-408-7544. The 800 number is down. Malcolm has joined us on the line from San Antonio. Malcolm?
Yes. I wanted to make a real brief comment about the legacy of Malcolm X. And the congressman spoke briefly about Malcolm X's ideas coming from his father, who was a Garveyite. The idea of black nationalism that I think Malcolm X brought to the nation was something unheard of in those times. And I wanted to pose the question and make the comment that right now we have benefited as a community from integration, but I think we also lost something. We supported our own black businesses in those days. We did a lot of things within the community, which helped the infrastructure of the black community. And my comment was based on Malcolm X's Garveyite black nationalism, later with the Nation of Islam. What does the panel think would be his stance today on the black community losing a lot of its infrastructure through integration? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks. Manning Marable?
I think that Malcolm would agree that integration, as it was implemented, undercut the solidarity and a commitment by black people for other African Americans to sustain the lack of the sustenance for black infrastructure, for black civil society, a weakening of what scholars refer to as linked fate, that increasingly there is a growing class stratification within the African-American community that is reflected in upper middle class and middle class African-Americans fleeing the central cities, living in suburbs or exurbs, and not being as connected as they once had historically been with black civil society, with sororities and fraternities, and with black churches, masjids or mosques. And all of this would greatly concern Malcolm.
Let's go to Detroit. Richard is on the line. Hello, Richard.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good.
I want to thank both of you for the beautiful program. And I just wanted to say that I'm 32 years old, and in terms of Malcolm's legacy, I belong to organizations that were directly inspired by Malcolm's contributions. Here in Detroit, I'm one of the leaders of the Michigan African American Leadership Summit, and nationally, I am a member of the Republic of New Africa. And both of these organizations were directly inspired by Malcolm X's contributions. The two CDs right now that stay in my radio are by rappers, one named Paris and another one, a rap group named Dead Prez. And much of the hip-hop today, especially the underground hip-hop, is directly influenced by Malcolm X's, his theories, his politics, and even the attitude of the young brothers and sisters that are doing this hip-hop thing today. Much of that, the resistance in it, is a direct contribution of Malcolm X's legacy. And I listen to some programs. This is an excellent program, but there are some programs that come on that basically break Malcolm X's legacy down to being opposite to that of Martin Luther mm-hmm. King. And I think that we need to be very clear that his legacy was much more deeper than that. It was bigger than that, and it is very much still alive today, although we don't have the leadership a lot of times that is out here vocalizing it and concretizing it through programs, through the organizations, through the youth. Malcolm X's legacy is very much alive and well.
All right. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
That Manning Marable, you have written about the influence on hip-hop and the fact that this is one way where we see the legacy very clearly of Malcolm X.
That's true. And I think that going back to the early 80s with Keith LeBlanc's No Sellout, Malcolm X began to shape in a very profound way the whole revolution of hip-hop music and culture very, very profoundly. But I wanted to get back very quickly to a point I was trying to make a few minutes ago, that is the hidden history of Malcolm. And since time is short, there are really only two things I wanted to say about this. One, the evolution Haley's role in framing Malcolm in the popular consciousness today really begins in the early 60s. He collaborated with another journalist named Alfred Balk, who actually was in dialogue directly with the FBI. The FBI funneled materials to Balk, through which Balk and Haley jointly wrote a piece entitled The Black Merchants of Hate, which really pilloried the Nation of Islam in early 1963. Now, Malcolm didn't know about this, about the FBI connection. But what's instructive is this piece becomes a kind of template for what evolves into the autobiography of Malcolm X. A second issue that I think we need to address are the circumstances around his murder. Historians have now pretty well documented, and beginning with the really fine work of journalist Peter Goldman about 30 years ago, that the three men who went to prison for the assassination of Malcolm X, one of the men, Talmadge Hare, was responsible. He was a party to the murder. But two of the men who served life imprisonment and now, thank goodness, are out, Norman Butler and Robert Johnson, were innocent and should not have been convicted, that there were actually five to six men, rather than three, who were involved in the crime. And the real parties who participated in the assassination of Malcolm X actually did a run-through a week prior to the murder itself. So the story, there is still a hidden history that hasn't yet been told.
A hidden history and grist for an entire program, because we can also talk about, and we don't have time here, I'm afraid, to talk about the cursory nature of the investigation, the fact that the crime scene was swept clean and there was a party held at the ballroom that night. Manning Marable, director of the Center for Contemporary Black History in Columbia University, will have to do that program. You're also the editor of Souls, a critical journal of black politics, culture, and society. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Manning Marable joined us from NPR Studio in New York City. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.